As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Join us this Saturday for an all-new episode of The Athletic NBA Show, Saturday Slam and Jam, hosted by me, Andrew Schlecht. I'll be joined by my co-hosts Alex Spears and many of the Athletic beat writers that you know and love. We will recap the week of the NBA, play some NBA trivia, and just overall talk about the league that we love most. So while you're flipping your flapjacks, tending to your yard, or just sipping your coffee on Saturday morning, listen to Saturday Slam and Jam on the Athletic NBA Show.
TV circuit breaker's in. And
page 5 clear. Roger. And we're getting a picture on the TV.
Yeah, go for it.
Do it again!
Okay, we can clarify the position opening I had to have on the
TV. With the beleaguered I have three kids voice. And a class. I'm going to get so much shit because I want to be efficient and get right to it because my wife has given me a hard out of 450. I'm already bracing for the shit I'm going to get from Ben about the hard out. But first of all, quick pleasantries. You doing okay? Everything good?
I'm good. Have we started? Is the podcast begun?
Well, that's what's dangerous. You don't know what Jade is going to use. You know, there is the podcast before the podcast. I wasn't intending this to be part of the podcast, but it very well could be. You know, I don't make that call, Ben.
Yeah, I don't. We're well aware. You control nothing in your life. It's
nothing.
It is established every time that I'm on the podcast.
Well, I can do a one and a two and a three and a four.
Hey, you good? Okay, Andrew Bogan, we got a little reporter talking here right now. He's going to ask you some questions.
And a five, and a four, and a three, and a two, and one.
Do it again! Do it again!
Welcome to the House of Strauss on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Stars hang with stars, winners hang with winners.
To House of Strauss podcast. I am oh so excited to be joined by the one, the only Ben Thompson. Really, the only way I can impress Andre Iguodala is by talking with Ben Thompson. You know, fun fact. Obviously, what do we call you? The proprietor? The founder of Stratechery? What's the proper title when you own such a Goliath in this media space?
Definitely proprietor. That's how I introduce myself everywhere.
Ooh. That's fancy. I'm a proprietor. Well, I'm having you on because you wrote about NBA Top Shot. Not just NBA Top Shot, but that general space. And I wanted to have you on because I do think that this should be taken seriously. And a lot of the media coverage of it, it's almost a little bit of like, gee whiz, isn't this goofy? It has that flavor to it, similar to the GameStop coverage, right? It's very fixated on the novelty of it and how it's silly. And something struck me about it because I'm writing an article. And I will say, as a sop to silliness, I just purchased a Bismack Biyombo layup for $69. So I should get that out of the way. And I'm hoping that explodes in value. I'm getting in on the community. But not everybody in the community is as much of an idiot as I am. And I was struck, Ben, by these are some sharp guys. These guys who are really heavy into the Top Shot moment selling. And so something's happening here. And I guess I want some – here's how we'll do it. I want some general thoughts from you on it. And then I will give my thoughts and you can tell me if I'm screwing anything up because I feel very far afield and out of my depth with this subject material, try as I might.
I mean, go ahead. It is your podcast. And I appreciate the confidence that's saying this is the only area where you are far afield, but continue.
It's the only intellectual blind spot I have. Everything else figured out.
Yes. Good.
I will tell you, I do have that feeling sometimes when I read what you write, I'll go, okay, I absorbed about 50% of this. You know, I absorbed 50% of this. I think I have about a little understanding of non-fungible tokens. I think I've got it. I don't have the whole thing. Okay, I will give this summary. And this is maybe my theory of the media, because that's where I'm comfortable. I'm more comfortable in how people misunderstand things than how they understand things. I feel like the reaction to the NBA Top Shot phenomenon is born of a certain counterintuitive nature of where things are headed. Because people think it's goofy and they think it's fake to be trading, let's call them playing cards in the form of highlights on the internet, right? It's this idea of, well, this is just goofy. And I think that's born out of this idea that the internet is where you get catfished, that it's a place where you can repeat an image endlessly. It's just endlessly scalable. So this is highly abstract. You are trading something that you can see in the form of a YouTube highlight. So what the hell is this? But I think with blockchain technology, it enables the thing to be even more guaranteed of authenticity than the real life product, than the card you would see at a trade show. And I think that's where perhaps the layperson is getting a little goofy footed on it, that there isn't that understanding that just because this is digital doesn't mean that it's abstract. And in many ways, it's more tangible than the actual cardboard in your hand.
That's pretty good. But you have to add this to your repertoire. God. I like writing about NBA Top Shot because it is the exact same sort of idea as you're seeing all these digital art auctions, or there's been music NFTs now. It's all the same general concept, but NBA Top Shot is a great way to talk about this because we have the perfect analogy, which is trading cards. And I think people, you know, because people talk about Bitcoin, like relative to gold. It's like, well, gold is like a real thing. You can use it for stuff, right? Like, what can you use Bitcoin for? And you have to think through it. Be like, well, how much of the gold that's out there is actually used for like making jewelry or used for whatever the industrial purposes or whatever things you can actually use gold for? No, by and large, gold is valuable because we have collectively decided.
I will find some purposes for it after selling my Biyombo card.
Right. And so you realize that, okay, there's a big part of money in general that is actually rests on the collective sort of, we've all decided that this is worth something. And, you know, you could kind of get there a little bit with the Bitcoin to gold sort of thing. But I feel what I like about the NBA Top Shot to trading cards is you can't give me an argument that there's like tangible value in trading cards. It's a piece of cardboard, right? There is zero value to it. And yet.
Well, you don't like the way the wind blows against it on the bicycle flaps? You're not into that? I mean, come on.
Yo, your Jordan flips around your bicycle spokes the same way that my, you know, Jack Sigma does. I mean, it all works the same way. So there's no actual value to a trading card, and yet they're sold for thousands and thousands of dollars, particularly lately, which I think is another point that goes into this. We can get to in a little bit. But so there, why is it valuable? It's valuable because we care about these players, because there's not very many made. And even not very many made, we kind of have to take the word of the manufacturer for it to some respect. Mm. We have to, you know, to your point, is it actually a real card? There's people that specialize in verifying them and giving them a score and all this sort of stuff. Like, there's this whole world around it. And but people still value it. Again, they don't value it in isolation. They value it because there is a community that has collectively decided to value these sorts of things. And that's the part, yeah, that feels fuzzy, but you go back and you think about it. The reality is the civilization by and large is humans collectively deciding that various things are important. And there's all sorts of stuff that's like this. And, you know, a lot of like our culture wars are about civilization fighting it out about what's going to be sort of important going forward and what's not going to be important. And so much of the stuff is not tangible. It's intangible stuff that's sort of in the air. And this is very much part of it. So what you have is exactly right. Owning a highlight is as meaningless in like real, like from a like physical asset value as owning a trading card, but there's a community that's decided it's worthwhile. And once that happens, there's actually a ton of advantages to it. You can know for a fact there's only X number of highlights. You can know for a fact who has owned it. There's no degradation in like its physical characteristics because it was stuck in bicycle spokes. It's sort of the same all the time. And not only that, to the extent that if I tell you, hey Ethan, I have a rookie Andrew Wiggins card. You know, look at me. I'm very special. And you're like, wow, he's got a rookie Andrew Wiggins card. He must be, you know, he's a great fan, or he's Canadian, one of the two. And you like my status goes up. Like you think, wow, that you know, that's very cool. I mean, I'm obviously being facetious to Andrew Wiggins, but you get the idea. Well, yeah, if it were an NBA Top Shot, everyone can see that I'm the owner of it. And so you almost get to, yes, broadcast your status as being the owner of this. And every time someone checks it, it's there. And again, I can print out my own trading cards on my printer right here. It's not the same thing because it's not like verified as authentic. I can have a video on my computer that's the exact same as an NBA Top Shot, but it's very easy to verify that it's not authentic. And the authenticity matters because a community has collectively decided it matters. And the reality is we as a collective decide stuff matters all the time. That's actually not that rare. Hmm.
And I would hazard that it'd be easier to do a Thomas Crown Affair snookering for a cardboard card than it would be for this, where it's very centralized and the NBA has a taste and you can go on the site and you can see everybody who owned it and what they bought it for. And there's that history on it. And that's giving people a feeling of security. What's interesting about it too is that it almost has a soft cap of scarcity, these moments. And again, for everybody following along, it's basically like a playing card, and we could get into the minutiae of it, but the broad strokes, playing card, but the playing card is of a moment, of a highlight that they have with some bells and whistles. So that's what it is. So Bitcoin, part of what makes Bitcoin so valuable is that they don't make more of it, that there's a cap on the amount of coins that they're ever going to make, in theory. This is interesting because it's almost a little bit of a gray area. It's scarcity with a little bit of flexibility where there are only going to be so many moments that these players generate in a career, but there will be more of them. LeBron will create a few more moments. And so it becomes this interesting intellectual exercise, I think, for these traders of, okay, how valuable is this one? How valuable is the next one going to be? And I think that's what's driving a lot of this. It's the intellectual exercise of it. It's very nerdy. Don't get me wrong. It's easy to mock, but there's something kind of fun about it. There's something fun about how important is this going to be to people in the grand scheme, according to all of these factors. And I think that's maybe why a lot of the people I'm talking to who are into this are fairly sharp people, because trying to game that or trying to work that is intellectually stimulating.
Yeah, I mean, this is where I think it actually is. I mean, helpful to understand, at least to somewhat abstract level, the technology behind all this stuff works. Where, it's funny because you mentioned centralized, and there's kind of a funny dichotomy here where the playing cards were definitely produced by centralized entities, but then they're just sort of dispersed. And now the way they're distributed and bought and sold is very sort of, you know, decentralized, right? eBay is the primary marketplace, as far as I can tell. And there's this whole network of like verifiers and stuff like that. Whereas the NBA Top Shot works a little bit differently. So it's basically based on a blockchain. I think at the very root, it's Ethereum. But the idea is that what makes blockchains inherently interesting, blockchain is the technology undergirding Bitcoin, undergirding Ethereum, undergirding all these cryptocurrencies that people have probably heard about. What makes it fundamentally intriguing is it creates the idea of digital scarcity. So the whole problem with digital, or the whole opportunity with digital, depending on how you look at it, is that you can copy stuff endlessly, right? To make a trading card, you still needed to actually print a trading card. Printing a trading card cost a couple cents or whatever it did, and you had to package it up, and you had to ship it to Walmart, and you had to buy it. And that was, you know, that all that stuff cost money, which meant you to produce an infinite number of trading cards would have been prohibitively expensive, because even pennies at an infinite time scale become gargantuan. Whereas digital, you can just copy an image endlessly, and it basically costs nothing. So and this has basically ruined the business model of media, because it used to be, the real cost, the real thing that reason why you could charge for music was because you were charging for a plastic disc. Once that was no longer the case, it didn't make any sense. And so what saved the music industry was a completely new business model that assumed that everything could be infinitely copied. So what's Spotify? It gives you access to everything, because why not? And so now Spotify doesn't sell plastic discs. Spotify sells convenience. You can still go pirate everything, but it's a pain in the rear end. Just easier to pay $10 a month to Spotify and get everything you want. So they're actually selling convenience. So that's been how digital has sort of changed media. But what makes blockchain so interesting is because it's sort of a collective sort of thing. These folks that are called miners are collectively verifying every transaction that happens on the blockchain. And so there's multiple people, so no one has a majority, and everyone can sort of check and see, okay, who actually owns what. Now, in the case of Bitcoin, all Bitcoin are fungible. They're transferable. I can change my Bitcoin for your Bitcoin, and we have the same amount of Bitcoin. But to your point, the total pool of Bitcoin is capped. But I mean, it could not be capped, and the idea would still hold where my specific Bitcoin can't be duplicated. It can be exchanged with your Bitcoin, but it can't be duplicated. And that's different than any other digital good before. And so the reason why that's compelling is you get all the benefits of digital. I can send it anywhere in the world. Anyone can see it, but it still is a unit of one. And that's the same thing. And so that's the same concept with these trading cards is you get all the, because there can only be a certain number. And so they can encode it. It says, okay, this LeBron James highlight, there's only going to ever be 50 of them. And this particular one is number 23 of 50. And no, they can't come along and make number 51, because it's like it's built in that it would make the whole thing lose its coherence. It wouldn't make any sense. And so and even that particular highlight, you can copy it, but it's not in the blockchain. It doesn't say this is 23 of 50. It's just some random highlight you got on Google Images. And so there is this bit. And what's fascinating about this is what I think makes Top Shot particularly interesting is this is actually an arena where they're actually leveraging real world copyright, where the NBA and the NBA Players Association owns these highlights because they're from NBA games and they're using the likeness of NBA players. And then they are basically extending that real world copyright into this digital area and certifying that these are sort of official ones. So you and I could start an NBA pot shot and we could sort of like take Google Images. And it's interesting, like the NBA would sue us, and they'd sue us in like real court because we're violating their real world copyright. So the NBA Top Shot is particularly interesting in this regard because it has this interesting crossover between real world copyright and digital copyright. But I feel like it's very easy to get so into the weeds with this stuff, but it is really important to get this bit about the, you know, understanding how it works, and the decentralization bit is kind of flipped on its head. where the
yeah
yeah sorry I feel like I'm droning on a bit, but it's
I love this. This is so interesting to me, and it is going to impact the NBA potentially. I think the idea is just to what scale, because I was talking to somebody who was big in this community, and he mentioned that they're going to be doing about $50 million of deals in a day. And it has that potential to sustain that and maybe even get bigger. This hasn't really hit Europe, for instance.
One thing that's important to know about this, just sorry to jump in, but they get a revenue share when stuff's sold. You can encode it into, these are called contracts, and they're basically bits of code that are on the blockchain. And when something happens, it follows a predefined set of rules that says, okay, now XYZ. You can make it so that every time a transaction happens, some percentage of that transaction goes back to the original owner. So, like, for example, I think there's this Meeple guy, right, that is selling digital art for millions and millions of dollars. And every time, I believe, that one of his works gets resold, he gets 10% of the price. So basically, imagine if you owned a real world painting, right? Once you sell it, it's gone. Like, you don't get a cut going forward. But in this case, and this is where it being digital is actually beneficial, you can not just sell pixels on a screen, you can sell conditions attached to that can never be removed. And so the NBA, I don't know what their deal is, with Doppler Radar Labs or whatever it is that does it.
I've heard figures thrown around like 5%.
Well, I don't know if they're getting ongoing transactions. Yeah. That's the big question, right? Where when stuff's resold and then the NBA makes money again. But it's definitely possible that it's basically like this revenue stream in perpetuity, that as the market goes up, it goes up. Now, one more thing. There's a very good chance this whole market's going to like crash. the idea of a blockchain and digital scarcity is real. I've been writing about this for 8-9 years, well before NFTs came around. Like, this was so clearly going to be a use case for the blockchain, because digital scarcity is so compelling, where you get all the advantages of digital and the monetization potential of scarcity. And so even if the market goes down, I think this will be something in the long run where it will build back up. Like, you have these hype cycles where stuff goes crazy, then it goes down, and then sort of builds back up into a real business. Like, the tech industry is like this, right? You have the dot-com era. Like, you see this cycle again and again. Yeah. It's probably going to happen with NFTs. But that is, and a lot of people come out and say, oh, see, it's all fake, blah, blah, blah. I think it's real. I think it's a real thing. It's probably going to crash, but it's a real thing. Because once you understand how it works, like from a technical level, once you understand the reality that we've been creating these kind of markets around goods for ages, this just happens to be digital. And oh, by the way, digital makes a lot of the things that make these markets attractive, like status, even more attractive, because you get a, just like everyone that shows this highlight knows it's yours. I think there is something real here.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Yeah, I think there's something real here as well. And the big question, I think, I talked to one guy who was saying that he wasn't really into NBA basketball before getting into this. And I thought, that's a little bit of a difference from the other get-rich-quick schemes that the NBA has had. They tried to get big into gambling, for instance. I wrote a column on NBA gambling. I love NBA gambling. But it's
does NBA gambling
niche.
Love you?
It did for that column. I got to brag. I got to give myself a little pat on the back for that one. But maybe if I was actually putting my own money at peril, it would be a different story. So I love it, but it's niche. It's degenerates mostly who care about the outcome of a Grizzlies Hawks game on a Tuesday night who aren't fans of either team. It's not the NFL. It doesn't have that broad popularity for whatever reason. Maybe it's too many games. I don't think gambling is converting many people into NBA fans. But when that guy said that to me, and it's very anecdotal, it's just one guy, I thought to myself, I wonder if this particular tranche of nerddom can actually create more fans for the NBA and could do two things for them. One, the obvious revenue source that it's opening up right here. Two, what if it's not just about picking the carcass clean? What if it's actually about growing something? And that is rather fascinating to me because nobody was talking about anything like this a few months ago. It's just how unpredictable is the world in the business. The NBA losing viewership is, of course, I've droned on
You've
and on
about.
Yeah, I know. It's caused a little bit of fuss, created a little stir. Is this their salvation, Ben? Could such a thing happen?
I who knows? I mean, I'm not going to go that far to say that this is going to be the salvation of the league. I think the league should actually fix the game before they get to that.
We can't let them know it's their salvation because then they're going to start slacking.
Oh, so let's they're just, slacking we'll on everything. Everything about the league is going backwards right now. The replay situation's out of control. End of game situations go on forever and ever and ever. The whining is on the court is both justified and annoying. The actual product. I live internationally. And I watch the vast majority of games on League Pass, International League Pass, and TNT, every single TNT game, this sounds off. It's incredible that who is like, someone needs to bang some heads together and have some accountability for the fact that your actual product is garbage. It's incredible. Like, I don't know. I have frustrations, let's say, with the league office and a lack of accountability affecting all parts of the game, from refereeing to team conduct to broadcasters. And I think the NBA should fix that before they worry about this. Sorry, I need to get my rant in.
But I think this might be the thesis of my next book, is that these things are connected, that sports are miniature monopolies, and no matter what, you're going to print money. The rules of gravity do not apply to you. And so that engenders a little bit of slothfulness. And it's okay, Ben, I get it. All your criticism's completely true. At the same time, what are you going to do? We're making money anyway. We're not that incentivized. There's not much reason to be hungry beyond pride.
Yeah, it is very interesting, though. I mean, I think you're right to focus on the rating stuff. I mean, I think what's been so surprising about the pandemic era, and I felt this myself just as a fan, is honestly what happened was the pandemic hit. I used to watch every single Bucks game and a bunch of other games as well. And suddenly I just had this time open and I filled it. And I got very busy with several other projects. And now I try to catch games, but they're often in the background. I mean, they're morning time here, so I'm often busy. And you know, it's fine. It's actually removes a lot of gravitate aggravation from my life, to be totally honest. I mean, part of that might be the fact that, you know, it's very difficult to get.
You like the aggravation. I follow you on Twitter. You like it. You like it a little
bit. I just like tweeting about LaMelo Ball to Warriors fans.
You and Damon, man. You and Damon trolling the Warriors fans to such an extent. But to what you're saying, I do think it was a little bit dangerous for sports to be out of commission, because people do develop new habits and they realize that either they don't need it or it just wasn't good in the aggregate. And I don't think that it's really done enough to completely hinder professional sports to a great degree, but you have seen some of that drop off. You are not an isolated case. I think all sports to varying degrees are down, and it's been masked in the way they're counting the ratings. They actually created a new system for counting the ratings, not a moment too soon, of counting out of home, which never used to count for the ratings. That means hospitals, that means places of business, that means airports, and sports bars, which are going to be even more of an influence when people actually get back inside of sports bars. And that's actually artificially propping up the viewership. So when we say sports are down, we're actually even hiding the degree of it, which is probably 10% lower than even what's being represented. So there has been a significant chunk that has fallen off of watching professional sports. Professional sports, obviously still viable, will print money, like I'm saying. But yeah, you do see that. You do see that.
Well, but I think that's what's so fascinating about what's happening now is, and why I think you are right to be somewhat bullish about this from an NBA perspective. The NBA's fundamental problem is that their cultural relevance has never been higher, even as the product, you know, is viewed less and less. And you've hit on this again and again in your columns that this is a big problem because they actually make money from people watching games. And so how do you solve that riddle? And in many respects, that's why the blockchain is compelling, because what's the problem with the NBA is that online, all that cultural relevant bits and pieces are endlessly replicable. And that's a good thing because you get memes, you get highlights, you get all this stuff on Twitter, you get discussions, but it's not monetizable because of that fact. And so the reason this is compelling is it's a part of the cultural zeitgeist like the rest of the NBA with scarcity attached, and scarcity can be monetized. And that in a nutshell is why cryptocurrencies broadly are so interesting and why so many people are so obsessed with them, because like the potential is to marry the internet to actual like ways to make money. And you know, the way the internet has worked out is it's been this, the only way to make money is to basically centralize everything. And so everything gets sucked into Google, sucked into Facebook, and then they throw ads in front of it. And they understand you better than anyone else, so they can put the most compelling ads. And they make all the money, and everyone else out there, it has more content than they know what to do with, and more readers than they know what to do with, and more listeners than they know what to do with, and no way to make any money off them. And so the reason why this is also compelling is, wow, maybe there's a different way to go. And by the way, that it's decentralized. It doesn't require something in the middle. Again, it's all a little fuzzy because the NBA, as a centralized entity, is selling officially certified Top Shots. And so there is a centralization element to it. But big picture, you can see why this whole movement in area is so compelling to so many people.
Yeah, and let's talk big picture, because a paragraph of yours kind of blew my mind, and I'd like your thoughts and expansion on it. Quote, "More broadly, the fact that a play in a basketball game can be made unique means that anything can be made unique. That does not, to be sure, mean that that said thing is valuable." See, I don't even know how to read. It's very embarrassing. Let me get closer. "That does not, to be sure, mean that said thing is valuable, but it creates the conditions for value to arise." What are the implications of that? Because that's pretty fascinating.
I think it's there's always a challenge when talking about this stuff, whether it be Top Shot or cryptocurrencies generally, is you say, oh, this could be, you know, this could be very interesting, could be valuable. Be like, oh, that's worthless. And there's or you look at newspapers 20 years ago, and people could be saying, oh, newspapers would be in trouble. Be like, no, look at their profits. They're making a ton of money. And there's a difference between like the reality on the ground today and sort of the underlying factors that actually guide and drive sort of the industry or the world, as it were. And so you look at the newspapers 20 years ago, to take the exact counter example, and you say, okay, right now these entities are making a ton of money because they've always made a ton of money. But why did they ever make money? Well, they made money because that was the only way to reach consumers at scale if you were an advertiser. And they actually made money not because they had great news or great reporters, but because they owned printing presses and they owned delivery trucks. And they had a geographic monopoly on an area, and monopolies are always very profitable things to have. And like, wait, so what if the internet comes along and you can spread text and images for free? You don't need printing presses. You don't need delivery trucks. You don't need newspapers to advertise to people. And you could see, oi, this industry is screwed. Right now, it takes time for the screwing to happen. Okay, well, you know, lots of longevity in these sort of incumbents, and so it took a while for it to happen, but it was always inevitable that it was going to happen. And so so when I say that creating the conditions for value, but value doesn't necessarily exist yet, it's the same thing, but in reverse. You can look out, and again, you could see this 7-8 years ago when I first started writing about blockchain. Okay, if you can imagine a world where you have all the benefits of digital, can spread, can show to anyone, can be seen everywhere, all the zero marginal cost ideas, but
you can make it scarce. Okay, that's very, very interesting, because now scarcity was always constrained by geography. It was constrained by the physical cost of moving stuff around. Now we're removing the constraints, yet keeping the scarce bits. That creates entirely new possibilities that can't even be imagined. And believe me, when I wrote that 7-8 years ago, I wasn't thinking about NBA plays. I was thinking about Bismack Biyombo layups, right? But it fits perfectly conceptually in this sort of idea where, we can actually create a world where a Bismack Biyombo layup is worth, 50 cents or however much you paid for it. I'm
selling it for nothing less than $100,000. Yep. Serial number 183, Bismack Biyombo layup. Just put it out there. Seeing where my cloud is at. Seeing where
it's a way to monetize the podcast. This podcast is going to become an NFT promotion show, which is basically like Clubhouse right now. But so that's the idea where digital scarcity and blockchains create the conditions for things to be very valuable. It doesn't mean they're inherently valuable just because you do that. And just like you see on the internet all the time, right? I sort of helped pioneer this sort of newsletter business. And I've written extensively about why it's a very compelling business model. And you have a direct connection to the customers and your average revenue per user is very high. It doesn't mean that if you start a newsletter, no offense, I mean, you'd probably be successful, Ethan, but if Joe Schmo starts a newsletter, that they're going to be successful.
Or if I start a newsletter and I do a very bad job,
But there's a ton of people going to Substack right now and starting Substacks, right? The reality is, and this is where online world is very different. Substack, the more people who fail on Substack, the better for Substack's business. You're like, what? That doesn't make any sense. Hmm. Well, the reason is that the more people who fail, the number of people who fail on Substack is a function of how many people try on Substack. And given the fact Substack, every marginal writer doesn't cost them anything, let's get as many people trying as possible so that the next Ben Thompson comes along on Substack and makes it big, and then they make a lot of money off that. They want more rolls of the dice. And this is something that people fundamentally don't understand. Back when Google IPO'd, people would look at, their average price per ad goes down every quarter. And all the old fogies be like, these internet companies are never going to make any money. Look at their prices keep going down. It's all, infinite number of ads. And they're missing the point that actually, given the fact it's all free anyway, zero marginal cost to show an ad, the fact Google is dramatically showing way more ads every quarter than ever before, such that price is going down, is a good thing because they're increasing their opportunity. They're increasing their space in which to monetize. And it's funny, Google's price per ad still go down, but that's because their inventory keeps accelerating even more than sort of their usage does. And their usage is accelerating a lot. Now they're making, billions and billions and billions of dollars. And so Shopify is another example. Shopify, got a lot of skepticism in the stock market for a long time. It's like their churn rate. They don't say their churn rate. I've heard their churn rate's really, really high. It's like, actually, Shopify wants their churn rate to be higher because the more people that try out, the more that are going to fail, but also the increased likelihood they're going to get that diamond in the rough and succeed. Anyhow, all this to say that creating the conditions for value does not mean value is going to rise up. But the more conditions you create, the more chances something's going to hit. And when it hits, it's going to be astronomical.
Yeah, like my Bismack Biyombo moment, serial number 183.
Well, I mean, this is a credit to the NBA and all how they have, believe me, I want to sit around and dump on, Adam Silver as much as anyone else endlessly. But this is an example where the sort of endless experimentation the league has done and being aggressive with this sort of stuff has paid off. It's easy to say, letting all their highlights go for free on Twitter and YouTube, how are they actually making money, all that stuff? They're not making any money at all. What about the core product? I guess that was an accidental Ethan impression, at least in the content.
So it sounded a little more like a delivery. It sounded like a Nate Duncan.
But this is an example. The same sort of league that has a very hands-off policy towards highlights on Twitter and YouTube and doesn't really enforce their copyright is also the league that's much more likely to hit on NFTs, just because it's an experimental mindset that I think ultimately makes sense. I mean, the NFL has done better than anyone else at preserving the old business model, and I'm not gonna sit here and say they should, that I know how to do their job better than they do, because they are clearly exceptionally good at that. But at the same time, there is something about when once the world has changed, yes, you can hold on to it for a very long time and make a lot of money doing so. And again, I think the NFL is probably doing a great job. I can tell them how to do their job. But if you're not the NFL, you there is some benefit to just leaning into the change, even though you don't have no idea how it's going to pay off. Because by leaning into it, you're more likely to discover the way it's going to pay off more quickly than other people will.
Well, it's fascinating how leaning into the change in many ways didn't work out before. Now they might have a billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar idea in that they went all in on NBA Twitter, on Twitter in general. Jack Dorsey loved NBA Twitter, and it did seem like the league got high on its own supply.
I think it's, and everything in the feedback toxic, mechanism of Twitter, I think, has been terrible for the league.
Yeah, they absorbed everything that was toxic and poisonous about Twitter. The players, I think, absorbed a lot of it, too. They became unhappy by Adam Silver's own admission at the Sloan Conference. All our superstars are miserable, and they're all in their phones. That's what Adam Silver said, the guy who is theoretically putting the happiest face possible on the league. But in the longer sweep of this whole thing, of them giving away all the content for free, of them trying to be on the vanguard, of them jumping in with both feet into this undetermined space, maybe finally, nearly a decade into the experiment, they've struck gold. And that might be the upshot of Top Shot.
Digital gold.
Digital gold, baby.
Upshot. Yeah, I didn't want to stop and say the upshot of Top Shot is a very nice line.
Well, you know, maybe I'll steal it from myself, maybe, because I can replicate it and there is no scarcity, at least as far as my own speech is concerned. But yeah, Adam Silver is a strange case because he has his strengths, he has his weaknesses. I think I get frustrated as well. I was very frustrated listening to him on Clubhouse. I don't mean to be mean, but very boring, incredibly boring. And Clubhouse can't be whatever that was, is my takeaway on that. You had him on your podcast. What's your view of from a more business tech perspective that you might have of the Adam Silver MBA?
It's difficult to divorce my business tech perspective from my fan perspective, to be honest. It's funny because there was this sort of time period 5-6 years ago where Roger Goodell was the worst commissioner in sports and Adam Silver was the best. And I think in retrospect, if your commissioner is beloved, you're in a bad position as a sport. And if your commissioner is hated, he's probably doing his job. And I think you can sort of look at how the NBA and NFL sort of, you know, been operating their businesses and quite frankly, profits and see there might be something to that. Like the reason why the owners hire a commissioner, and again, the commissioner is supposed to be on the side of the owners, is because he gets to be the bad guy. And they could be buddy-buddy with their players and say, the commissioner, man, what a jerk he is. You know, and there's this weird position in the NBA where the commissioner's buddy-buddy with the players and the owners are kind of like, and then you have that, you know, like the Harden on the Rockets, like the again, I have no objection to Harden asking for a trade. I think Tillman Fertitta is a terrible owner. And you know, by all means, you should get out of there. But he also should have been fined a whole heck ton of money for showing, you know, being at a club when he was supposed to be at training camp. I mean, and it's unfair to expect the owner to do that. The commissioner should do that. And to me, that's just an example of, and I worry about this, again, as a fan. And I do think the quality of the game has gone down. I think the replays are a perfect example of this, where it's very easy on Twitter to show a highlight and say the refs missed a call, and this obsession with getting the call right and completely forgetting you're selling an entertainment product. And you know what?
Yes.
Watching a free-flowing game is entertaining. Arguing about a blown call is entertaining, to be totally honest. Watching a replay is not entertaining at all. But like it's like this weird technocratic mindset where must get it right, yes, must get it right. And you're forgetting the entire point of the experience.
It does seem very technocratic and reactive to whatever is being said about it in a way. And perfect can be the enemy of good when you're trying to solve certain problems. And I think that's a great example where, okay, you're trying to make sure that there's no wrong call, but your method for fixing it changes the game and makes it worse and makes it less
entertaining. And part of the reason we love sports and why basketball, you know, I think is still, you know, I think the analyst guys miss the boat in a sufficient way that still makes it fun is the human element. Like, what's fun about basketball is how do guys interact? How does teams come together? Why do teams have so much talent and just fail? Or why do teams have no talent and seem to succeed? Like the chemistry angles and all this sorts of bit. And the refs being fallible is part of that. I honestly do wonder. My sort of working theory is that the Donaghy scandal was actually what really was way, 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 way worse than we ever really found out. And that's why the NBA is so dramatically overcorrected, because things like, for example, what's the clear path foul, right? That is, if there's ever a call in the game that should be a ref judgment call, it's that, right? We all know if it's a clear path,
so
right?
Clear.
But why do we have to legislate it and make it by letter of the law? And there's this, you can see, there's this bit in society, like societies generally, where if you end up in a world where everything, if it's legal, it's right, and if it's not legal, it's not right, you get a crappy world. You get like the worst excesses of Wall Street. And the NBA has devolved into that, and it's devolved into players foul hunting, like and the refs having to double check everything, and this replay culture. It's a culture that has abandoned the spirit of basketball for the letter of laws, and that's great if you're a former lawyer who wants to analyze the game. For the rest of us, it kind of sucks.
Oh yeah, it's definitely an exchange of spirit for letter, and to bring it back to moments. It undermines the moment. You know, if I watch something, and what I love about sports is I'm in the moment, right? And I see a buzzer-beating three-pointer. I don't like the sense that this is going to be adjudicated and maybe taken away from me. That is a tax on the moment. If I, in the moment, feel at some level that it can be taken away, then it's
It becomes like the NFL. And like the NFL like can lean into that. And every play has a replay, and they've kind of made it work for them. But that's not basketball. Basketball is about flow.
Yes.
Basketball is about back and forth. You have to play both sides. You can't sub out on one side or the other. Everything about the current NBA game works against that. Foul hunting works against that. Replay works against that. Timeouts, way too many timeouts, works against that. Like, why can't we adopt the FIBA rule that you can't have open play timeouts? Like, FIBA games are amazing at the end of the game because you can't call timeouts every single moment. And there's this weird abandonment of like, let's make the game fun to watch in favor of let's get it right. And you're getting the big picture totally wrong along the way.
It's crazy. And I think the clear path foul is the perfect metaphor for it, because why are we here at the clear path foul? Well, it really bogs up the
game.
We
want to see people dunk. We want to see people dunk, right? And so let's get more people dunking by stopping the game for a replay that no one understands. That's the other thing, right? Like, people can get the, like, oh, wait, it's the end of the game. It's super close. You can, like, there's an intellectual argument to be had for it. There's no intellectual argument to be had for the clear path foul. And the clear path foul is the equivalent of the intentional fouling of a foul shooter, a bad foul shooter. It's taken the spirit of the rule and completely twisted it, right? The whole point of awarding foul shots when you're in the bonus is to penalize the defense. And now it's being used to penalize the offense. Like, oh, well, you should be better foul shooters. Like, no, the spirit of the law, the spirit of the rule is completely backwards here. And all this stuff's fixable. I have all my fixes. You fix the intentional fouling by, if you're in the bonus, you have the choice of sideline out of bounds or free throws. Just easy fix. Like, oh, well, at the end of game, you won't have fouling. I'm like, that's great. Let's get rid of fouling at the end of the game because it's miserable. Do better at the rest of the game. Take out open play timeouts at the end of games. You can only call timeouts when there's a stoppage in play. The end of the games will be so exciting. It will blow your mind, seriously. Give more ref judgment on like clear path fouls, things on those nature, and take away all the replays. Like, screw, let the refs get it wrong.
I support your candidacy. Of course, there is this unknown aspect of maybe Adam Silver wants to do all these things, and it's like herding cats with all these.
But that's
owners,
part of the problem.
Right?
He's got to be on the owner's side. Like the Charles Barkley was on the Bill Simmons podcast a few weeks ago, and it was so striking to hear him talk about the fans. And like, who talks about the fans these days? Players don't. Adam Silver doesn't. Like, what about the at the end of the day, this is the entire thing. We've forgotten the big picture. The big picture is that it's an entertainment product. It doesn't exist without the fans. And I'm all for player empowerment, but let's at least acknowledge the fact that we all have this product and this opportunity, not we, they do, because of the fans. And
well, me to a certain extent.
Well, yeah, I mean,
I try to keep that perspective. I mean, I was fortunate enough to get fired, Ben. Fortunate enough to get fired. And I say fortunate enough because it's almost like being present at your own funeral. You know, people are quite nice. They say things that you wouldn't ordinarily hear. And I got a lot of very nice emails from readers because you're often just judging, oh, the people reading this are the people I see on Twitter or maybe some commenters. And no, it's this pharmacist in Hayward. And it's this, you can go out down on the line of just regular people who read your stuff, and they're not into having a loud voice on social media apps, but they get something out of it. They like basketball coverage. It connects them to something they enjoy, and that's ultimately what it's about. And it's easy to lose sight of that. And it was so interesting to me. I can certainly understand why the players don't want to play the All-Star game. And I can certainly understand why they have to, because TNT owes the NBA $7 billion remaining on that contract, unless they want it out of it, which they, I believe, could ask out of if the NBA didn't play an All-Star game. But it was so strange to just hear this conversation so divorced from fans, because the NBA All-Star game is about fans. And I was thinking, in David Stern's NBA, you would not be hearing a bunch of people shitting on playing an All-Star game before ultimately shrugging and going and playing in the All-Star game. That is a situation where maybe Adam Silver is too light a touch.
Yeah, I mean, and you think about this, like, this whole new revenue stream, right? It's also from the fans, right? And you're hopeful that it will create new fans, and hopefully it will. But man, they're giving the fan of a product that seems to have completely forgotten. Again, it's forgotten its entertainment product. Like, that's the core problem with the NBA. And in this desire to figure out new ways to make money, like, why do you spend time on NBA Twitter? Why do you look at highlights? Because it's way more fun than watching a game. That's a big problem.
Yeah, and to close out, I see myself becoming a little degenerate and addicted to this Top Shot madness. I do. It's interesting. It's interesting. This idea, the only moment for LaMelo Ball is some run-of-the-mill assist where Gordon Hayward did most of the work, and now you're thinking,
that's the first ever LaMelo Ball Top Shot.
Yeah, that's the first LaMelo Top Shot. Is that going to be valuable, or will some incredible highlight he does later on be valuable? How do I figure out this market? Rookies, so they're so overvalued, or at least so valued. Is there some player I think is really going to pop, who's going to be better than people think, and you're going to have the rookie card? It's a little bit addictive, man. I mean, are there any, have you checked it out, or are there any Bucks moments that you're pursuing?
No, I'm refraining. I still watch the games. Not to sound like a complete old fogey, but I do have a way, Ethan, to tie my NBA ranting together with our NFT discussion, which is what makes blockchain interesting. To your point, or what you quoted, is it creates the conditions for sort of value to be built, and that's compelling. Again, whether there ends up being a market crash or whatever, there is something real here, and I think in the long run it will be meaningful. I think what the NBA needs to do is create the conditions for moments to happen, for fun to occur, for entertainment to be had. And that, I think that's the common thread in this conversation.
Yeah. Ultimately, at bottom, I believe the games have to matter, and they have to resonate in order for everything to be healthy and everything to be sustainable. And it increases my enjoyment. I like when America is as tuned into the NBA as it was during that Warriors dynasty run, during the Bulls run. But I will wrap up. Ben, thanks so much for stopping by, man. I think that we're all smarter for your presence. Do you have anything to plug beyond the obvious? Uh-oh. Hello?
Oops, I turned my mute button on to yell at my daughter to be quiet. In this case, it is my family members causing the problem, not yours.
Well, I'm about to have to, the Paw Patrol episode is ending, so that is
no, so I said, search for Ben Thompson. The website is Stratechery. It's hard to say, hard to spell, but yeah, you can check it out. There's free articles. If you like it, you can subscribe, but it's okay if you don't.
It's pretty much the smartest, what do we call it? Tech newsletter, tech blog, whatever it is. It's smart as hell. You should all be reading it. You should all be
subscribing. And I have a four-pay podcast too. My new venture. Maybe we should do anything. Dithering.fm. Three episodes a week, 15 minutes an episode. It's going pretty well.
Dude, that sounds incredible. Check that out.
That was so fake, but I appreciate your affirmation.
It sounds incredible. I'll just do a very smarmy outro. Ben Thompson, check him out. Great stuff at Strategic Dateria. Fantastic, wonderful. Jade Hoy, great producer. All you fans, it's all about the fans. Can't happen without the fans, everybody. House of Strauss out. Stay safe. Is that smarmy enough? Is that good? That was good right there.
It was great, Ethan. Great job.
Thanks, man.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.